Welcome, everybody, to Redacted on this Wednesday. It's Community Wednesday, which we're trying out here over the past few weeks. We've been doing our deep dive live episodes, but today it's really a chance for us to hang out with you guys and cover some of the big stories of the day with some great guests, but also really be able to feature your comments here on the show. So get in any of your super chats, Rumble rants, any live comments. We'll try to bring them up here on the screen as we cover the stories today. And there's some big war developments in the war with Iran between the United States, Israel, Palestine, Yemen, and of course, Lebanon. So we're going to get to all of that today on the show.
We're also going to talk about the U.S. economy seems increasingly in trouble. You probably don't need us to tell you that inflation has continued to go up despite promises that prices would come down under the Trump administration. Why is that happening? How much longer is that going to happen? Nobody wants that. Do you want that?
No, I mean, well, think about it. And then credit card delinquencies, like right now. So credit card delinquencies are the first thing on the list that are happening, up like 29% or something like that. And then auto loan delinquencies are the next thing. And then, third on the list is going to be home loans or home delinquencies. And, of course, foreclosures. There's a number of markets across the United States who are already predicting like a huge wave of influx of foreclosures as a result of this as well. But don't worry. So
raise your hand if you remember 2008. That was fun, right?
Yeah. But don't worry, though. Scott Betson says, Treasury Secretary says, I'm tired of hearing about this K-shaped economy. Like, it doesn't exist. Stop talking about it. So all of his Wall Street buddies are fine. But yeah, I'd love to.
I'm tired of living it. So what do we do?
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Well, I'd love to hear from, I would love to hear from you guys in the chat room and just let me know. Like, let us know here on the, you know, what are you guys seeing right now? Let's see, like $20 for a porterhouse. Where is that? Like the grocery store, Sherry?
Yes. I mean, that's not. Go ahead.
I got good news coming out of it all, though. Now I believe they're making a push so that the owners of corporations no longer have to disclose who owns them. So,
well, that's good. Right.
That's good.
I'm going to start a corporation and buy my meat in private.
B. Allison says, yeah, inflation is out of control. It is out of control. So we're going to look at those latest new numbers that just came out today and unpack all of that. Also, one other story we're going to talk about a little bit later in the show today, the idea of getting rid of letter grades. So, you know, your University of Michigan has really gone full woke, basically wanting to get rid of letter grades for students because of mental problems for children, mental stress.
What causes mental stress is not being prepared for real life. Remember when our child first had letter grades for the first time in high school, and he was like, what the hell is this?
Yeah,
he was not prepared and even more anguished. So yeah, how's that going to work out? We're going to talk about that in a second. And yeah, let us know. You know, I know how expensive life is. It's back to school time, but there's always like one product that I see and it just sets me over the edge. And I'm like, what? I mean, I know how expensive everything is, but then there's that one thing. The other day it was a $7.99 chicken quesadilla at Taco Bell for my son. A chicken quesadilla was $7.99. And I was like,
what? It's probably not even real chicken.
I'm sure it's not. This is fast food we're talking about for a teenager. So let us know your one product that's like set you over the edge. I really want to know. And we will commiserate on that because misery loves company.
It does. All right. So welcome to Community Wednesday. Great to see everyone here in the dog days of summer. So glad to have you all here. Before we get to our guest talking about the latest with what's happening right now in this Gaza peace deal, we want to tell you about our friends at Rumble Wallet. So Rumble Wallet, what is it? Well, Rumble Wallet is a place for you to control your money, and no one else can control your money. And this is a paid advertisement for Rumble Wallet. They are sponsoring this portion of the show. If you actually want to control your money without having big banks involved in it, you can actually try it for free. Just go to wallet.rumble.com and download the Rumble Wallet app right there, and you can start today. And you can actually, when you start today, you get $10 in U.S. stablecoin just put right in your account. So they're going to give you 10 bucks just for opening the account. What's amazing about Rumble Wallet is that you can invest in anything you want. More of your money lands where you want it. It's very easy. And of course, they're working with MoonPay, so it all is tied together. And you can invest in crypto, you can pay people, and no one can tell you what to do with your money. In fact, you know, with so many creators we've worked with over the years that have been debanked, so many independent journalists who've done incredible work, have been debanked because whether it was PayPal or somebody else just like, nope, we're not going to allow you to have access to your money. And the beauty of this is that no one controls it. You get to control it. Not even Rumble has access to this. So go to wallet.rumble.com/redacted. Try it right now and get $10 and use that code redacted10 to get $10 in USAT right in your account. It's so easy to set it up. Just check it out right now at wallet.rumble.com.
Somebody in the chat says $35 for a can of baby formula, and I could not believe it. And I looked online, and they're right. $35.
What brand?
For even Target brand.
Oh, my God.
$35 for a can of baby formula. So, oh, my gosh. Naughty Kitten says, I'm subscribed, but I can't chat. I see you. You are. You're here. We're listening to you.
Chips are even worse. So much for a snack.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, keep them coming in. But keep them coming in. We're going to take your Super Chats, Rumble Rants, all of that today on the show. So, well, a lot of moving pieces today in Israel's war against Iran that is being carried out by the United States. First, it appears that Iran's patience is wearing thin. There seems like they are done negotiating with the Trump administration and going so far as to announce that they're planning to wait out Trump's term. Just wait out Trump's term until 2029 and there'll be a new administration, but they are prepared. They said, we have the oil, we have the resources. Oh, and by the way, and these are their words, not mine, we didn't realize how weak the U.S. military was.
Ouch.
Ouch. Like, wow. Okay. And then the U.S. also wants to provoke a war against China over Taiwan. Okay. Good luck with that. And Russia at the same time. Okay. Good luck with that. Meanwhile, here's what Brandon Weikert had to say, a friend of the show, national security expert. He said, based on conversations I've had today with several pro-war types, they and Trump is listening to them. They think the U.S. can just ride out the Iranians until they implode. Iran believes the same thing about us. The difference is that our economy is on a timer set to implode. It's already starting. And it will long before the Iranian regime implodes due to their shabby economy. The balance of power has shifted permanently against the United States in the Middle East. And, you know, experts today saying, look, if the U.S. ends this Iranian war boondoggle, that essentially is the end of the U.S. petrodollar. Think about that. And what would that mean for the U.S. economy? So everything on tenderhooks right now. President Trump, though, today tweeting this, posting on Truth Social, the USA today has a total control over the Strait of Hormuz. Okay. I think we'll keep it. Our naval blockade is being called by everyone a wall of steel. And there's nothing Iran can do about it. They have no Navy. They have no Air Force. Their remaining soldiers are unpaid. The IRGC is decimated and fleeing. And their leadership is uncertain. Okay. But that's not what we just heard from the Iranian side. So then if that's the case, then just end this thing. Just walk back and say, hey, we won. We're done. We won this thing, you know, and we're just going to bring our football and go home. But Iran doesn't seem to be playing around. They just released a statement a short time ago saying if the threats against Iran occur again, hundreds of thousands of miles of energy transmission lines, thousands of power plants, all American and non-American systems, and even global infrastructure connected to the internet would be at risk. And friend of the show, Colonel Daniel Davis, said, we better pay attention to this because each time they have made these arguments or they've said they are going to do something, they've done almost all of them. So do we want to keep poking a bear here and have all of our energy transmission lines, maybe undersea internet access, all of it shut down? Okay. Meanwhile, Iran is pushing a new package and their new package approach right now to regional peace, tying together Gaza, aka Palestine, Yemen, Lebanon, alongside its own demands for sanctions relief and security guarantees, essentially arguing that none of these conflicts can be solved in isolation. And Israel can't get away with bombing Lebanon and Gaza anymore if the U.S. wants to have peace with Iran, which brings us to some stunning new developments between Israel and the Palestinian peace framework.
Well, Israel is now signaling that it will not adhere to President Trump's peace plan. So, you know, that whole Gaza peace plan, if we doubted it, we were panickins or had Trump derangement syndrome. Israel's saying we don't have to do what you say. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. And they have been. In fact, hundreds, if not thousands, have been killed in Gaza since the signing of the peace plan, which is not a peace plan, so we shouldn't be using the term peace plan, but yet I said it again, peace plan. Okay, now, meanwhile, Israel is also holding the remains of approximately 1,700 Palestinians for possible use in future exchanges. This was reported by Israeli outlet Haaretz, citing two security sources. Despite Hamas currently no longer having any Israeli captives or remains. Now, Shin Bet chief David Zinni and the Israeli military reportedly support retaining these bodies in case Israelis are captured or disappear in the future. Now, how many more will they have if they continue with their plan to execute Palestinian prisoners? Haaretz says that most belong to Palestinians from Gaza. They allege that they were October 7th perpetrators, but of course, they never prove that. They don't really have to. The international community never demands it. Israeli legal experts said the state lacks authority to retain those remains without the security cabinet formally establishing such a policy. But again, nobody makes them do anything they don't want to do. So that's what they're doing. Sima Atayim is the news editor at The Cradle, and she joins us from Lebanon today to discuss all of this. I guess let's start with Iran, because Iran continues to expand who they speak for in the region. And they are saying that we demand peace in all of these places. Many of them don't have peace because Israel's doing what they want. Do we have that correct from our assessment sitting here in the middle of the United States?
Yes, of course. I mean, and Iran knows that when it makes these demands, that it's not going to be, an easy ride with Israel. And really, I mean, the thing with these peace agreements or these plans, like what we have in Lebanon and Gaza, is that it's actually fundamentally flawed to call them failed plans, like to call it a failed peace plan, for example. I mean, when peace was never the objective, as you mentioned earlier, because these actually work as political instruments designed to sanitize permanent occupation and grant actually international cover for the ongoing Israeli military presence, as well as enforcing unconditional capitulation for the peoples of the region under the guise of diplomacy. And that's aside from also the public humiliation of outright rejecting the plan that Trump was so proud to announce on Netanyahu's part, for several reasons. One being that it's a smokescreen, and two being that he needs to plead his extremist coalition who sees the so-called peace plan as a betrayal. But the way we view these things over here is that they are designed to actually to just serve as a front for what Israel continues to do in the region. So and Iran knows that when it demands a stop to wars on all fronts, and this includes Yemen and it includes Lebanon and it includes Gaza. At least the issue with Gaza though is that it's signed on to this plan, so that's kind of like a trap for Hamas as well, which makes it harder for Iran to exert leverage. Lebanon, Iran's having a hard time. So as you said, Israel is doing whatever it wants with this. It's just a core deception to call it a peace plan in the case of Gaza, because it's more pacification than peace, really, because it wasn't meant to succeed. So the Board of Peace is basically like a cushion, for Israel. And it's giving also Washington this aesthetic of diplomacy, and it gives Washington the ability to distance itself from Israel. But also, as you see, Israel doesn't always listen to Washington, but Washington doesn't seem to have that big of a problem with it. And meanwhile, Israel is expanding control over more than 65% of Gaza, which is, of course, keeping millions in these killing zones. And just one, the moving the goalposts is one thing with Gaza, by the way, which is, that initial July proposal for this plan was supposed to be a parallel process, as in, Israeli military withdrawal would happen in tandem with Hamas disarming. But within days, they actually bent to Israeli pressure and they shifted the demand to unconditional disarmament first. Before Israel even considers that we use, ultimately, these plans are there as a front. They are actually, in reality, tailored to Israel's security demands, if that's what you want to call them. That's what they call them. So there's asymmetry really there when a besieged and occupied people are told to hand over their weapons. But, to an international stabilization force, by the way, which doesn't exist yet. I mean, who's in it? It's like only 200 strong force, right? It's, I think, Morocco maybe only, and who else? Morocco and one other country, and really not Uganda, right? So this is how we see things over here when it comes to these kinds of agreements.
Right. And I want to ask you about now Israel is dropping white phosphorus in southern Lebanon, forest, hills, civilian areas. Is that actually happening? You're in Lebanon, and is there any attempt to stop it?
No, there's no attempt to stop it. And it has been happening since 2024. It is not a new thing. As you know, there has been a war on Lebanon since 2024 after Hezbollah here opened a support front for Gaza. And so we've been in this cycle since actually 2023, but then they intensified their war on Lebanon in 2024. There is evidence for the ecocide. You see the desertification of South Lebanon. You see the uprooting of trees, the burning of trees, you know, the scorched earth tactics. So that there can be, so that it's very hard for life to thrive in the south because, you know, in South Lebanon, agriculture is, you know, what the south really survives on. So it's this complete desertification, which is also, if you recall what we saw in South Gaza with Rafah, it's very similar in South Lebanon. And no, there isn't anyone trying to stop that. I mean, even that framework agreement that I discussed last time I was on the show with you guys, I may have mentioned it last time, but Lebanon even signed away. It basically promised Israel that it won't even file complaints like at the Security Council against Israel. So I don't know how much the Lebanese state, who is currently preoccupied with just like satisfying, you know, Israeli demands, giving into U.S. pressure as well as Saudi and Turkish pressure. But I don't know how much they're doing about that. But again, it's the same all over in the region where there's just this complete impunity. There's this soil contamination. There's, you know, the chemical use that is deliberate, the habitat destruction. This impacts entire ecosystems, the deforestation, which is like, OK, I mean, what's the excuse for that? Right. What the Hezbollah fighters hide behind the trees. I mean, it's true. But it still doesn't excuse the extent to which this, like, you know, annihilation of every living thing is happening. There's like a deliberate, the livestock and marine toll is you know, soaring. There's the rubble, the toxicity, the air pollution. You know, when we see this in Palestine as well, right, with the uprooting of trees and the burning of. And even the poisoning of livestock and killing of livestock deliberately, you can see that in the occupied West Bank. So what we're seeing now is just an extension of, you know, what Israel is doing in Palestine, of course, to just be able to expand its borders, which is why Israel has never defined its borders so that it can keep expanding them and then claim, of course, that this is for security because, oh, there are these people on the other side who want to attack us. Oh, we have no idea why. They just, you know, they just woke up one day and decided, oh, we should attack our neighbors. So this is there is not really much going on in terms of attempts to stop it, to be honest with you.
You're in Beirut.
Yeah.
What is life like for the average person who lives in Beirut, obviously under maybe the constant threat of bombings, attacks that we saw? Mm. What is life like for you right now? Like services, just basic services, internet access, electricity, and day-to-day life?
Yeah, well, day-to-day life has been a struggle in Beirut since really forever, since the civil war, but also you could say since the financial crisis in 2019. And really, the main war is happening on South Lebanon now. But up until a few months ago, yes, Beirut was also being bombed. I don't know if you know this, but over here, the government hardly gives us electricity. So we mainly run on these generators. And then you have like... the fuel is very costly, and then you have these mafias that kind of like rob you with the prices for the fuel, and you have the constant drones overhead. Even here in the capital, now that the aggression on Lebanon is not happening in Beirut at this moment, but it could resume at any moment, we have the drones all the time over our heads. You know, so really, in terms of basic services and day-to-day life, it's been a struggle for a long time. But in the, I don't want to call it the aftermath because we are still in the war. You know, Iran was able to, you know, temporarily, you know, stop the war when it came to Beirut, but not the south. And then, of course, you know, the U.S. and the Lebanese state took credit for that, but it was Iran's influence. But so Basically, it's difficult. It's stressful. It's very expensive living here. Power is always an issue. I'm surprised my internet is working well today, actually. The drones are just like have become a constant in our life. A constant reminder, you know, that we're being surveilled, basically. And the aggression on the south is just ongoing. Drone strikes, artillery. For those of us that are monitoring it, we are also living it. You know, you have some people living on their own on another planet in Beirut. But for those of us who are paying attention to this, the war is very much, you know, impacting all of us. So it's just this ongoing thing, you know, that it's not... And ever since 7 October 2023, we kind of just moved into a new phase of this idea of an open war where post October 7, the word ceasefire loses its meaning. And that's why here we just define, you know, an open war. And you also have this government that's just so preoccupied with like pleasing the US and Israel that it won't even give like the basic necessities. Or try to, secure those basic necessities that we would need. But honestly, we are like scarily used to this now. And for a lot of us, the main concern has just become really stopping the aggression on Lebanon and getting the Israeli withdrawal, happening. But it's looking like it's going to take a very long time, you know. So, yeah.
Right. And so Iran can make these demands and say, we demand peace in these regions. And Israel can sort of say, make us. We're going to keep doing what we're doing. So what they're essentially signaling is that they're not going to hold to the Gaza peace plan. They're going to expand into Lebanon. And their intention is to keep expanding, is to continue going. So if that is successful and there's no one who's actually going to stop them, the U.S. is certainly not going to. We don't know what Iran's going to do, but they have to defend their own borders right now. That means that this will eventually come to where you are in Beirut. And is there this sense of inevitability that eventually this may or may not happen?
You know, again, unfortunately, Lebanon, we have an issue here, which is that we are not all being able to recognize who the common enemy is, which is the number one requirement for being able to show any kind of strength as a nation. So we are not at all in denial about the fact that the thing is, even if it doesn't happen physically reaching Beirut, it is happening in all other means. Like they are influencing things like Israel is starting to influence things like. Like, first of all, through surveillance, we're already occupied in Beirut, you could say, you know, for example. Or the fact that Israel can influence now through threats and coercion, for example, who the Lebanese army wants to appoint as commanders. So in a way, Beirut is actually already occupied without being physically occupied as it was decades ago. So that's really how I think of it. It's like, of course, we are aware of this threat that if no one's going to stop it, it can reach us. But again... It's already feels like it's all of us. You know, we all have, you know, we all have loved ones and friends and colleagues in the South. We all have a lot of people in our lives who are from the South. I myself, I'm not from the South. It doesn't feel separate from me. It's only those people in Lebanon who are not being able to understand that Israel is their enemy that may kind of live a life that's separate from South Lebanon if they're in Beirut, for example.
Yeah, we have that same sort of divide and conquer, you know, mentality here. We cannot coalesce because of the ruse of partisan politics. So there's no real uprising, populist uprising for that very reason. It feels very
familiar. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Sima, thank you for, speaking to us under these circumstances. And thank goodness that you had power today and internet access briefly that you can be able to communicate with us. And thank you for your great reporting over at The Cradle. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
Yeah.
All right. Stay safe. Thanks, Sima. It's unbelievable. Like to think, you're sitting there and there's constant drones outside monitoring you. And then to have your electricity just powered by diesel and whether or not you have the fuel. And then these these sort of mafioso types coming around, like extorting you, taking your fuel from you, no internet access, and
right.
to be able to do the journalism that she does. So incredible. So thank you for that. Let's see. Let's see. Any good comments coming in? That's a good point, Jordy. Jordy says Iran is one of the few countries that lacks a Rothschild's controlled central bank.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why they hate them, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, she's awesome. Spiritual Warrior says she is awesome. That's right. Seema is awesome. All right. So keep your comments coming today on this Community Wednesday. Really appreciate it. How's everyone's summers going? You guys, your summer's going well out there? Has it been a little...
It's hot. I'm tired of being hot.
It's hot as sin. I know. It's been crazy. So yeah. You guys, like back to school, when does that start for most people? Like, what about the Pacific Northwest? Like, Philip, you're up in the Portland region. When's school start up there?
Yeah. I think it's already started or starting soon. My daughter was just talking about it yesterday that she thinks it's kind of BS that they've robbed the, she was saying that they've robbed kids of like another month of summer.
Yes.
Because they're going back so early.
Yeah.
But I think they usually go back about now. So.
Yeah. Our kids started this week as well. So a little discombobulated in this house getting back.
Yeah. Globu for Lover says summer, I don't get to do anything fun. So it doesn't matter. Oh,
well, it matters.
Yeah.
Oh, you're here and you're hot.
DK's boss says we live by the Spokane fires. It's so smoky. You were dealing with that too,
yeah,
right, Philip?
Philip was dealing with that.
Yeah, yeah. It was pretty smoky here because it just kind of gets in the valley. And yeah, we had, it's cleared up now, but yeah, we had probably 3 or 4 days of it. Not nearly as bad as probably about 5 years ago when there was a fire just south of Portland. And it was just really bad here. So I can empathize them in Spokane.
Yeah.
M.M. Hortzel, I don't know how to say that name, says, please report on the USS Abraham Lincoln story. I don't know if you guys have been following this, but according to the Military Times, and this is the Military Times and Stars and Stripes, that multiple USS Abraham Lincoln sailors have tried to basically jump overboard, kill themselves. I think upwards of like six to eight of them now because they've been deployed so long. Going on almost 300 days, I think, on the deployment time now. So it's brutal how long this has been. Even at the start of the war, we were reporting from sources who had just been on the USS Abraham Lincoln and were in a part of that process, how they were about to be redeployed for like a third stretch and now a fourth stretch, which is incredibly uncommon. And apparently food supplies have run low. Really sort of terrible circumstances there. I don't have any insight into what the circumstances are on board, if they're still dealing with their leaks and all of this, but miserable.
Yes, food shortages and depression and whatnot. So support our troops apparently means leave them there.
Well, and also like, you're hearing from these sailors, they're saying, for what? Like, why are we fighting? Why are we doing this for Israel? Like, what are we doing? This has no benefit to the United States of America at all. What are we doing?
Right.
So you can understand the frustration.
All right. We're going to talk about our economic woes. If you're an American and you have to pay for things, then you already know. But we're going to talk about the continuing signs of trouble in our economy and what that means for us. Before we get to that, though, we want to tell you about our friends at Masa Chips, because we are actually having Taco Wednesday tonight, and I will be serving Masa Chips. It is a great addition to any meal because Masa Chips are made only with 3 ingredients, which is corn, sea salt, and grass-fed beef tallow. That's it. No seed oils, no mystery chemicals, just real food the way it's meant to be. Now, they have a variety of flavors. You should check it out for yourself. They also have a sweet version that's a lot like the Taco Bell Cinnamon Crispers. Do you guys remember those? Not when they were twists. No, the original Taco Bell fans when they were like this, triangles. Masa has a much better version that's not terrible for you and fried in seed oil. So check it out for yourselves. They are also very hearty, so they don't break when you pack them in your kids' lunch, and they don't break in your dips. Nobody likes that, right? Because then you have to double dip. That's a whole thing. You know your chip etiquette. And if you're a nacho expertise, such as me, who's been sharing nachos with my sister since I was a baby. I'm always one step ahead of her. You want to get the one with the most ingredients that's not going to fall apart because it's got soggy. So anyway, I can talk about chips all day, every day. I will not. Check them out for yourself by going to masachips.com/redacted news. You can get 25% off your first order if you use the code redacted news. One more time, that's masachips.com/redacted news. 25% off. Use the code redacted news.
Chip etiquette.
Yep.
I actually do my nachos. I load every single chip individually. With
that's not possible. You're a liar.
It is. That's what I do. I put them out. I put them out on a cookie sheet. I use the round chips, but lay them out on a cookie sheet and top every single nacho with the ingredients. And
that's not really nachos. That's a nacho appetizer. Nachos, the dish has to be in a whole pile. And the ingredients have to be disparate.
Every time we go out, like anywhere, like if it's like a baseball game or something or whatever, it's always, I'm like, what are you getting? I'm just going to get the nachos.
Yeah.
Always.
I love nachos.
Like a nachos fiend.
And my sister and I used to have to share the nachos Bel Grande when we were a kid. It was like a once a month treat. And that was very stressful because if you didn't eat around and went straight for the center, then we get in a big fight. And so nachos, it's like playing chess. You have to be one step ahead of your opponent. At all times.
Yeah.
You have to, if you are not a nacho sharer, you don't know this, where have you been in life?
Luke Sightwalker says, Clayton loves Iran. I bet he wouldn't move there, though. No, I like America, and I'm going to stay here where I live in America. But I love all countries. I don't have a problem with any countries.
I for sure do not want to blow up Iran.
I don't want to kill school children.
The people of Iran.
Definitely against war and killing people.
Yeah.
So
I don't want any country to be bombed by my country. I definitely don't want any schools in any country to be bombed by my country. I don't want to pay for that. I don't want the moral responsibility of that. So, yeah, I guess I do. That's kind of a moral imperative to love your fellow man, no matter your religion.
Yeah, I don't have a grudge against Iran.
Nope.
Yeah.
I don't.
All right. Well, let's talk about the U.S. economy. The U.S. economy appears to be hanging by a thread, by the way, and you wouldn't know that by looking at Wall Street and the exuberance over the massive AI infrastructure build-out that they're all very excited about, celebrating the earnings reports of companies like CoreWeave last night. Instead, talk to average Americans and the latest inflation numbers just out today, and look at the Consumer Sentiment Index. First, let's just talk about the consumer sentiment. This is how good people feel about spending money right now. Look at that on the right side of your screen. It's at near an all-time low. In fact, its consumer sentiment is now worse than the depths of the 2020 lockdowns. It's worse than the financial crisis in 2008 when all the banks collapsed and people's mortgages went belly up.
It's worse than it was in the late 70s when interest rates were like 12. On houses, like we feel worse than
that. Well, it's even
worse
than that. It's actually worse than the 1980s when inflation was at 18% and interest rates were at 18%.
Uh-huh.
It's even worse. So that consumer sentiment is worse than that. You couldn't even buy 18% for an interest rate. And today we got the most damning numbers of all. The new inflation numbers out this morning show that the consumer price index jumped nearly a point from this time last year. So you can see there 2.5% up to 3.4%. By the way, do you think that number is accurate or way low? Way low. I'm going to say way low. Of course, so many experts have called this a K-shaped economy, where different parts of the economy move in different directions, meaning the wealthy, the tech industrial sector continues to move up, do very, very well. Wall Street, middle class, and average Americans continue to go down, creating that K-shape. Well, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent the other day said he's sick of hearing about this K-shaped economy, that it's officially dead. Listen.
So we are starting to see... I got sick of hearing about this K-shaped economy. I can say here definitively, the K-shaped economy is over.
Oh, it's over. All right. He announced it on CNBC, so it's officially over. Dr. Chris Martinson is the founder of peakprosperity.com, and he looks at all of these trends. He's been studying them for years and one of the keenest observers of all of this. Chris, great to have you back on the show. Welcome back.
Thank you, Clayton. Natalie, so great to be back here with both of you. Lots to discuss today.
Yeah, our pleasure to have you. So first of all, maybe on the Scott Bessent point of this K-shaped economy, is he right? Is it officially dead?
Yeah, he's absolutely right, because it's now an I-shaped economy. There's this little line where we all inhabit, and there's this little dot of elites lording over all of us, I guess.
Right, so the K-shape has now just turned into something bigger for, you know, for the elites have made such a small impact, and now the rest of us are dealing with, because the number's out today on credit card delinquencies, mm-hmm. car loan delinquencies, and then next foreclosures, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, Washington is so out of touch, and I think Scott Bessent exemplifies that with sort of his smugness. You know, Trump obviously out of touch. That all of these people who are hanging out around that bubble of Washington, D.C., I'm sure, you know, Trump said, you know, we're doing great. The economy is doing great. But who's in that we? If you're a centimillionaire, it's obviously the best of times, you know, but it's also the worst of times. If you're an average person, inflation is absolutely eating everybody's lunch. And we know that wages are not keeping up with inflation, but that's inflation as they've told it to us, which we all know is, it's a pretty big lie. So, what do I say? Listen, everybody knows the truth already. We're struggling. People are struggling with this. If you go out to eat, if you just try and buy a burrito, if you have to pay an insurance bill, if you just have to replace a condenser on an HVAC unit, you know the reality, which is that inflation is rampaging through this economy right now.
And so the numbers are 3.4% that we've seen. Numbers in the 3% and 4%, that's from this year to last year. So that's a full year, but we keep getting this every month. And it's been since the pandemic in the 3s and 4s. So we know now that our prices since the pandemic are, I mean, what would you estimate? 40% what we were paying before for most
easily.
Goods?
And it kind of depends where you live. Yeah. You know, if you're an urban consumer, you're elderly, you're on a lot of drugs or something, it's probably a lot higher, obviously. So here's a standout. I mean, listen, it's a big report, the CPI report to tear through, but here's a standout. They told us that for the month of July, heating oil, which is diesel, went down 1.7%. But people who actually had to buy that substance discovered that it started out at about $3.20 a gallon at wholesale at the beginning of July. Finished at $4.20 a gallon by the end of July. So it's somewhere between, it went up 33% overall, but somehow they did their magic. They massaged the numbers and told us it went down, and obviously it didn't go down. So this is the level of prevarication we have to deal with. The BLS constantly massages, lies, gives out political numbers rather than real numbers, and that's just the nature of it. But I think everybody already knows what's true.
So I'm going to put these price of items up here on the screen because this Glow Blue Forever says the only thing that's cheap to him is eggs right now. But so here is where we've seen the cumulative price increases. This was Creative Planning from Charlie Belillo posted this on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Cumulative price increases in the U.S. over the last 7 years. Pound of coffee up 123%. Pound of ground beef, 81%. Dozen eggs up 76%. Gas utilities, home prices, fuel oil, auto insurance, electricity, gasoline, transportation, restaurants, family health insurance, shelter, groceries, used cars, and new cars. Like the price of used cars skyrocketing, even like higher than the new cars prices, which is crazy on the resale side of things. And the same is true of homes now. Even the resale home prices have ticked up to a point beyond even new construction homes, which is crazy. I don't know how, I mean, how is this sustainable? I mean, maybe it's a stupid question, Chris, but it's not keeping up with wages. So it sounds to me like we are about to hit a wall.
I think that's right, Clayton. So there's a number of things on there that are missing as well, which really bothers me. So they say shelter is up, you know, 2.3% over the last year. What's shelter? Well, that's my house. Well, you know, what does that cost? Well, they estimate it and they do these things, but what they don't do is they don't actually ask the question, how much did your property taxes go up? How much did your insurance binder go up on your home? They don't ask those questions in terms of actually having to keep your house. So how much did maintenance costs go up? When you have to replace a roof this year, it's like 50, 100 grand now, where it used to be 20, 30 grand or something, right? So that part never comes into play. And I, you know, if I want to know what's actually going on with inflation, I go to the Chapwood Index. You know, Ed Butowski has been just tracking the same 200 items in 50 cities. He's done it for decades, you know, and he just adds it up. But he includes taxes and insurance, which are just completely left out. When they say inflation, they always tell you about fuel and eggs and clothes and things like that. But what about taxes and insurance, right? Those are the things that are really starting to bite. So, A, inflation is a lot higher than we've been told. B, why do they do that? Well, because they can keep your Social Security COLA adjustments down. They're like, oh, officially inflation was 3.2%. Hey, Mrs. McGillicuddy, here's your 3.2%. To your point, Clayton, that becomes unsustainable because you can't possibly stretch that budget 3.2% and have things square up next year if your property taxes went up 15%, if your insurance went up 20%, et cetera. That's the system we're in right now, and it's really grinding people down. And every day we have the administration try and pretend that's not true, tell us we're wrong for thinking we're in a K-shaped economy. Is just another day that I think they're setting themselves up for a big political disaster at some point.
Yeah.
But for who? Because, I mean, this happened during the Biden administration. This is why Democrats lost, in large part. Now we see Republicans doing the exact same thing. The American voter is absolutely exasperated with this villain rotation. We don't know where to turn because we know Democrats will do the same thing. So, I mean, I know you're not a political analyst, but I what do you think of this? What do we do? Sentiment?
Yeah, they all keep borrowing. I mean, we just got the numbers today that they're going to borrow another $734 billion, which will push us over the $40 trillion debt level now. We keep saying 39, we're $39 trillion in debt.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's Democrats or Republicans, they're going to push us over $40 trillion under Trump.
No, that's the thing. And Natalie, listen, if I heard you before I came on screen, but if you want to join a party where you don't support wars, you want to keep that, you know, fund and blood and treasure home and do things here. And if you don't want deficit spending, which party do you belong to?
Neither. Right?
We're all politically homeless at this point.
Yeah.
Right. There's no options. You know, it's Tweedledee, Tweedledum. Kay Hutchinson said, we're choosing between the evil of two lessers. You know,
nice. I saw someone in the chat room just say, I'm glad I'm a political atheist, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think so. We're starting to hear these rumblings that, you know, a third party, or as Ron Paul waggishly said the other day, a second party might finally form.
Right. It's true. It is. With a uniparty, it's true.
So what are the signs that are troubling you the most? I mean, we just looked at, you know, home prices and energy prices and things like that. But there are other cracks in the foundation that we don't see as just everyday news consumers?
Maybe besides what you just said about insurance and taxes, like, is there something other that's like a big red flag?
Yeah. So the thing that's like every morning I wake up, first thing I do, weirdly, I check the yen and I'm checking interest rates because something has started to crack in the firmament of this machine that's been operating for decades. And we don't have a U.S. economy and a Japanese economy and a European economy. They're kind of all welded together at the macro scale in terms of financial markets. And so what we're seeing now is that Scott Bessent has pulled out the big guns, and he's convinced the yen is, you know, too cheap, needs to be stronger. So they did this intervention recently, lasted about 3 days. Apparently, traders aren't scared of the U.S. Treasury anymore. Bad sign. But we're watching interest rates start to climb, and that couples to oil prices. And they've been doing everything they can. I mean, administration has been doing everything they can to keep oil prices down at the front end, right? So these are futures contracts. It's a little wonky, but, you know, they report, look, oil's not that bad. I guess the war's going not that bad. But on the back end, when you look at diesel prices, when you look at gasoline prices, more importantly, when you look at availability of those, where are our inventories of those things? Now we find out that we're running short. And so sooner or later, what's going to happen is we're going to have to find a thing where we're going to either have to ration these things, you know, get your digital ID, gas coupon, QR code on your phone out, or we're going to have to let prices adjust to a point where that demand is killed enough to match supply. And that's that. When that happens, economically, what we're seeing now, a positive correlation between the price of oil and also yields on our long debt. And that makes sense, right? Because as the price of oil goes up, inflation goes up, yields, you know, bonds don't like to be on the wrong side of inflation. So if we get to the situation I think could happen, the risk here is oil doubles, triples in price, does whatever it's going to do. Bond yields now explode. Like, the U.S. has to fight this battle where, you know, 10-year treasuries are trading at 7, 8, 9%. And we can't fund $40 trillion of debt, rolling over debt in our markets at much higher rates, because now we have to roll them at higher rates, which means we have to pay a higher yield, which means we have to pay more interest expense, which means our budget deficit falls short, which means we have to issue more bonds. And that makes the yields go higher. And it's just this cycle that happens. And that's what keeps me up at night, is that I think we're getting closer and closer to that moment, and we're not having a national discussion at any level. We used to have discussions, deficit matters, debt matters, you know, what are we going to do? Nobody's talking about it out there in what we call official sphere. That's why we're talking about it.
Right.
What do you think happens with the petrodollar then? What do you ultimately think happens? This, like, the U.S. dollar is a reserve currency. Like, if this all collapses under the weight of this Iranian boondoggle, what do you think happens next?
That's very bad. And here's why. So first, we go back to 2022, and the Biden administration weaponized the SWIFT system to sanction Russia and freeze Russia's sovereign reserves, which proved they were neither sovereign nor reserves. And that really started something in motion. That's when gold really started to decouple from 20-year-long things it had been coupled to, like the value of the dollar, negative real interest rates, et cetera. Gold suddenly started charting its own course, and we started to see the BRICS nations, right? That includes China and Russia. They're starting to figure out how to decouple from the dollar. That's already underway. I don't think there's anything we can do to stop that. But then the Iran war comes along, and every president, I checked my history. The first time I wrote about a warning about a potential in Iran war was 2008, right? So I've seen this under every administration, but every president was like, no, that's a bad idea, until Trump said, let's do it. And now what's just happened is the United States, we've suffered an extraordinary reputational damage that was sort of sitting there. We had this veneer on our reputation, which said, hey, we might not be the nicest kid on the block, but we're the toughest kid. You know, we can enforce our will anywhere in the world. And that's just been proven not true, because a country with an $8 billion defense budget with home court advantage just bested a country with an $880 billion defense or offense budget, and pretty soundly. So that now is the equivalent of what I call the sinking aircraft carrier moment, this moment where suddenly all these countries wake up and go, oh, not that tough, can be bested. War has changed anyway because of drones and missiles and other things. The United States apparently has a very clunky, expensive, slow military-industrial complex. Wow, new world. So who are we going to make friends with in this point in time? And the obvious answer is China, because China's going to come in and help restore order, and that's going to be much to their benefit and much to our deficit. And this is the problem. We have an $800 billion a year trade deficit with the world. It gives us an extraordinary standard of living here in the United States. It's fun when you can just emit, you know, dollars that you print out of thin air and get real things back, you know, cars and clothes and oil. It's good. And that requires us to issue $800 billion of dollars off our shores, and for those countries to absorb them, pass them up to their central banks, and for those central banks to hold on to them and not remit them, not send them back, maybe buy treasuries. That's been the deal for a long time, and we can already see in the data that's starting to break down. And it's such a big shift. It's really hard to articulate just how magnificent this is.
Yeah. You know, the administration keeps this propaganda up that communism is the big threat. Our way is better. Capitalism is better. But our way has never really been tried and trusted. We can't actually know what we as Americans can do, because our tax dollars are used to fund global hegemony. I was just reading last night, Clayton heard me arguing with AI about the way that the United States destroyed Nicaragua in the 1850s so that Cornelius Vanderbilt could establish a trade route through Nicaragua. That's not really capitalism. That's global terror in the name of capitalism. So it feels to me like we're like those college students whose parents get them into elite universities. We don't actually know what we're capable of doing. And so when I see this, like, capitalism is better, I'm like, yeah, but we're not actually doing that. What do you think of this anti-communist propaganda and the flip side that we are doing capitalism when we're really not?
No, I can take the front end of that real easy. I'm no fan of capitalism or socialism, right? This whole idea that you have more than I do, so it should be redistributed somehow. That doesn't work. It's always failed. But you're right, Natalie, we don't have capitalism. Capitalism would be with the government enforcing a minimal rule set so that the free scrum of the free market could play out. This past couple of weeks and months has become completely obvious that our markets are anything but free and fair. The oil market's being manipulated. 100%. Gold has been manipulated.
Yeah.
Silver's been manipulated.
The whole market has been being manipulated, right?
the whole thing, right? So it's not capitalism, right? And then you find things like, here's what should actually happen. So if somebody like Pfizer makes a deadly product that kills and maims a lot of people, they should go out of business, right? But that never happens because the government runs interference for them, says, oh, we passed a PrEP Act. You don't have that right. Yes. So we don't have capitalism. Capitalism is where liabilities and assets and consequences all kind of line up, you know, and may the best person win. And we don't have that.
We haven't.
You're right.
Have we ever, do you think?
So smart. I mean, maybe early 1800s, maybe. I mean, you know,
maybe.
Then you get an Abraham Lincoln, I mean, taking over. I mean, talk about, you know, creating like a police state under Abraham Lincoln. I mean, so did we ever really have, maybe in the early 1800s when we had a very agrarian society and the government mostly stayed out of the way. We're very much against taxes and getting involved in anything. So maybe that was the last time, 1823, perhaps.
I don't know. This is a discussion that needs more research, but it's clear that, you know, this is propaganda. We're not actually being allowed to succeed on our own under the guise of capitalism.
And Senator Rand Paul says clearly in his book on socialism, like the United States picking winners and losers, to Chris's point about Pfizer and other companies, or we're going to support Palantir, these AI infrastructure build outs with an attorney general task force that's going to sue if you don't support AI and flock safety. I mean, all of this stuff. You're picking winners and losers. That's socialism.
Yeah, or fascism, and under the strict definition, the merger of corporation and state.
True.
And I think it was Simon Dixon who pointed this out to me. So I'm really glad about this, because I think I labored under a misapprehension for a long time, which is we have the executive branch and we've got Congress and the Senate, and then they make laws and corporations sit under there. And he said, no. Corporations are at the top of our heap right now, and all the rest of that machinery is just their owned machinery. And China does it differently, because China kept their political class at the top of the heap. And, you know, if Jack Ma's disappointing him, he disappears for a while, gets reeducated. I don't know. But the corporations are subservient to the government. And here it's obviously different. How did all those flock cameras actually get installed? I work on our local planning board, right? I know what happens. If somebody, that company showed up in my little town in Massachusetts and said, we're going to install poles by the side of the road. Ooh, well, you know, there's going to be a review and it has to go through our DOT, and there's going to be permits and there's going to be inspections. And you see all these poles and they're just popping up on the sides of roads, where every jurisdiction has its own set of rules for why you can and can't, how big the poles have to be, the offsets, you have to get dig safe to make sure you're not putting them into all this stuff. And somehow they just like, boom, 100. How did
thousands
that happen?
Of them. How did you're right about that.
How I mean, did just, that happen?
You literally have to call your local utilities to come out and spray paint your grass, so you know where the sewer line is, you know where the electrical lines are buried, and they're just doing it. Thousands of them all over the country. That's a great point.
So how does that happen, right? So again, that happens because the corporation involved is super to the governance that's supposed to be in charge. And that's the only way I can see it at this point.
Yeah. Great discussion. Very smart. Thank you, as always. Dr. Chris Martinson, always great to see you. Where can people learn more about all of your writing? At peakprosperity.com, is that the best place?
That's the main place. I'm there 7 days a week, and I've been there for decades doing the same thing, just trying to figure out what's going on and help people see what's coming. And I want everybody to be resilient, prepared, and have buffers for what's coming, because the way I see the world, very high chance that something we might call, the Irish would call, the troubles are on the way. But you know, trying to do it with levity and humor, and with a sense of, let's just all be responsible for our own outcomes and get our power back.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Chris, great to see you. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you, Clayton.
Great stuff.
Thank you, Natalie.
All
my pleasure.
Right. What do you guys think?
The troubles,
about?
He calls
the
it.
The troubles.
Nobody.
Yeah, I just feel like, our government style is really just, it's like a fascist oligarchy with a constitutional democracy or constitutional republic mask wearing a I love capitalism t-shirt. That's basically what it is to me.
Yeah.
Let's put that on a t-shirt.
Love that. No, that's so true. It really is. When you see that we're picking all these winners and losers all the time and we're totally supporting it, that is not capitalism.
Yeah. What capitalism?
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that super chat. David, maybe you know where that misspelling is. Misspelled years as Yates in your Maui post. I don't know what that one is, but we'll
Yep, I got the super chat and went and fixed it.
Awesome.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you for your super chat. Here's another one. Lou Elizondo, he posted around the year 2021. We only have 8 years left, so enjoy your time. Look into this. So, all right, 2021, so 2029.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's the end of the Trump presidency, so will Trump be our last president of the United States? Like, that's the end of it? That's the end of the line?
I don't know.
Like, traveling Wilburys? I'll look into that. And I check.
You know what? I'm not comfortable in any kind of certainty at all of, like, we are collapsing. We are going to go to war with this. We are, like, I'm always surprised. I don't know. I'm here for the ride. So no. Don't come to me for predictions.
We're lucky enough to hang out with our friends, Neil Oliver and his lovely wife, Trudy, a few weeks ago in Scotland. And while we were talking to them, and one of the things we were talking about was don't trust people that, like, know for certain anything. Like, the people that are like, this is the way it is.
Right.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Do you know what the hell you're talking about? Like, do you have,
you'd have less people drinking Kool-Aid.
The certitude of things.
Well, yeah, like, I feel like there's a pretty strong correlation between, like, how likely somebody is to make declarative statements like that and how little they actually know about it.
Yeah, totally.
It's like an inverse
relationship. Yeah. Between certainty and intelligence. All right. Let's see. We're going to move on and talk about this new no letter grade system in college. Okay. Would you go to a surgery? Would you let a doctor operate on you that you don't know, that never got letter grades, that just got a pass-fail system?
Yeah.
We're going to do your heart surgery, Mr. Morris.
Sure.
Okay.
Did you pass? Well, did you get an A in school? No, I was able to pass.
I got a pass. It was a pass-fail.
Pass-fail.
Okay. So we're going to talk about that.
They gave me a did pretty good. I got a did pretty good.
Yeah. I did say the Holiday Inn Express light last night. All right. We're going to talk about that. So let your thoughts in now. Get your chats in. We'll take your chats here on this one. Do you think that we should get rid of letter grades in school, University of Michigan? But first, if you think about investing in real estate, but you're just not sure where to begin, or you already own property and want to build a portfolio that can actually lead to financial freedom in your life, because the government's not going to help you, you need to protect yourself. I want to tell you about the free this is totally free, the free weekly wealth workshops from our friends at Sidera Wealth. And I've been working with them for more than a decade now. And every Thursday at noon Eastern, the Sidera Wealth team goes live to break down the real world strategies behind successful real estate investing, helping people plant a flag for their own family to start building financial freedom. I'm telling you, and if you think you know everything, you don't. Like, I've been investing in real estate for years, and I'm constantly learning. Like, don't trust people that say they know everything. No, I know everything. But no, you don't, and neither do I. And so you can always learn something about how to navigate the taxes that we're dealing with right now, the financial structure of an IRA, all of these things. And our team there at Sidera Wealth can help you do this. They'll teach you how to evaluate opportunities, get insights from special guests, including property management professionals, all of it. So the first, and by the way, I should mention, this is something special just for Redacted viewers. The first 100 individuals who register for this free event and attend one of the workshops are going to receive a complimentary Freedom Roadmap Toolkit that walks you through all of that. And that toolkit includes a free book, the Freedom 5 Formula ebook, and its companion workbook, all for free. And it's designed to help you define your goals, lay it out with your family, and then begin creating a personal roadmap towards financial freedom through real estate. The workshops happen every Thursday at noon Eastern. Registration is free. SideraWealth.com/workshops. SideraWealth.com/workshops. Join the wealth team Thursday and start building your personal roadmap for financial freedom. All right. So the University of Michigan won't release official grades for its freshmen this first semester. And they say it's all in an effort to curb the mental health crisis among students who might end up getting a C or a D in their first few months on campus. Now, it says new pilot program. It's starting in the fall of 2027, and it's going to apply to about 3,500 students that enter the College of Literature. science and arts each year.
Okay, so not medical students, like mathematicians and the hard scientists, they still have to get grades. Okay, so you're not going to get a doctor that just passed their anatomy class.
So it'll be like liberal arts. It's going to be people that are going to study like painting.
Because what does grades matter anyway for those people?
Like, what a slap in the face to like to liberal arts students. They're like, you are worthless. Yes, we don't need you. I mean, that's basically how I read that. Like,
in many ways, like, it's chemists
matter.
It's an admission.
You guys don't.
Yeah, you guys don't matter. It's honestly, in many ways, you're right, Philip, because it's almost like an admission that, like, your liberal arts degree is kind of worthless in an era of AI and everything. Like, really, what are you going to do with a?
But what is the social value of someone who got a C in British masterworks of literature and someone who got an A? Like, society doesn't really have a way to use those two people, right? Have we figured that out? One is a better college professor and the other is not.
It's all for academics. That's all it is, right?
Right. So socially, to our society, it matters very little, right? If you...
Well, I mean...
Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but like, think about it like this. So you can look at liberal arts as being like less necessary as like, you know, on a global scale, as like a chemistry student. But if you take somebody that's like, you know, a linguist, and they're actually translating old biblical verses, and they're like working on correct translations, that can have real world impacts that can create wars and split churches. Like, you want these people, you want people that are historians that are you know, like doing these liberal arts. You want them to be top notch. Like,
but the problem is that in a class like that, it does not actually filter out who's better and who's worse. So, for instance, someone who is taking a class in, let's say, British Masterworks of Literature, that's subjective to the teacher and whether or not they understood the texts in the way that the teacher wanted them to, whether or not they wrote books or essays or, you know, term papers the way the teacher wanted them to. So the grade, who cares? Like, society has not found a use value for a C in that class versus an A in that class, because that matters who the teacher is. Right? And yeah, so I mean, does it matter in real life if they get a grade or not, according to this system? It kind of doesn't.
Well, right, but like they say it's sort of like the mental health stuff, but if you think about it, like somebody gets they're like, well, you failed. Well, how close was I to passing? Well, we have no idea. Like, you just failed. You know, it's like, at least with a C, you can be like, well, I can work a little harder and get up to a B for your own, like, you know, goals. But like, pass or fail, it's like, well, we don't know where you were on the scale. You just failed. Sorry.
Right.
At the heart of it is the mental health issue. I mean, this is the point. It's in order to curb mental anguish from getting a B or a C.
Mm-hmm.
No, like my freshman year at the University of Pittsburgh, I didn't do very well because it was like thrust into this world. You're having to get your ass out of bed. You get, you know, go to an 8 a.m. statistics class when you're, you know, a teenager. And you have to do it all your own. There was no parent there to yell at you to go and do it. And I didn't do very well. And it was motivation for me, like the fact that I got a C in statistics, you know, and I didn't do very well. It prompted me to like try harder. And then I did better. And then I got on the dean's list for working my ass off after that.
You're not supposed to want to do better. You're supposed to.
The point is, but like, I guess
you're just supposed to want to pass. Like, you're just going to pass. That's it.
I guess. And then be protected, like be a little snowflake, you know, protected in protecting all of those people from what?
I mean, what about the mental anguish, though, of like an engineering student who's like busting their ass because they know they're not going to get a job if they don't have a 4.0. And they're like, wait a minute, that guy doesn't need that guy doesn't have to do that.
Because he's like, taking that's a history mental of anguish right there, don't you class. Think?
You would think.
Next, they'll start doing it in athletics. They're like, okay, everybody, there's no first, second, or third place anymore. Everybody just wins or loses.
you either win or lose.
But then it does say here that they are eventually going to have to move to a letter grade system. So why did that break from letter grade system allow them? Like, they're not going to be prepared, right, for when that eventually happens, for that eventuality when they do have to. And that's something, you know, our kids went to sort of more progressive schools when they were really small, and it was, you know, proficient, mastered, not proficient. And then when my son eventually did have to deal with letter grades, he was like, what the hell is this? And he was woefully unprepared to take this bit by bit to see his progress and say, oh, I didn't do well here. I'm going to have to make it up here. He just was completely unprepared. So we're really saying we don't care how prepared you are. We just want you to be here and we feel good. Right. And that's not preparing them for the real world at all.
I know, Mr. Hogslice says, I know a security guard that has 2 master's degrees. True story. Oh, I know a lot of people that have master's degrees that don't make any money at all and are wildly in debt and have nothing to show for it.
Yeah.
So I know quite a few people like that, actually. Let's see. That's just to keep the Michigan Wolverine football team intact.
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
I mean, there is a high, you know, dropout rate in college. So I think that they're thinking people get into this situation, they realize they're not prepared for it, and they leave. And so there probably is some retention motivation here where the university's like, we better pass them into their next semester or they won't stay, because a lot of them don't. And so it's probably more motivated by profit than by actual care about these young people.
Yeah, because if these kids drop out and they're anguished, they're having mental anguish. I mean, I knew, because I bet you the freshman dropout rate is significant. Now, there was a kid down the hall from me at University of Pittsburgh dorm rooms who dropped out. I didn't see him after the first semester.
A lot of people drop out and realize, like, oh, this is not the real world.
Or this is too hard. I got a D. I got a C. I can't deal with this. So maybe this is a way to keep them in and keep...
Well, that's exactly what I was just saying.
Well, yeah, but also the money, I think it was so... A lot more people are not going to college. Fewer and fewer people are not going to college.
That's double negative. Fewer and fewer people are going to college.
Fewer and fewer people are going to college. That's right.
Yes.
I need to go back to college.
Yes. I'll test you tonight on double negative.
But I think,
mixed mental.
But I mean, I think Clayton just, hit on something there.
Yeah. Go ahead.
With the money. The money.
Yes.
Like keeping people there.
Yep.
Like, because if it's cushy, they at least get that first year out of them.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And if they can just even get that one extra semester out of them. Like, I don't have to worry about letter grades. I eased my way into the water. It was a little, a little warm. Okay. It was a little difficult. But yeah, I'll come back next semester because,
Then you have friends. Then you have a life in your university town. But if you drop out in the first semester or the first quarter, you've lost relatively little. So, yeah, I think it's profit-driven more than anything else. And
they're already doing this. So they're already doing it at Swarthmore College, Wellesley College, and California Institute of Technology. And I guess MIT has been doing this since 1968.
Interesting.
So those dummies.
I mean, MIT. I could see, like, because the first year is mostly just, like, prereq classes, so it's like I could see you're not really building any, like, towards your actual like field of study. So, I mean, if they're going to do it, I would say, I could see that first year. I don't think it's really going to create very good students, but it may, I guess, I don't know.
Right. But I'm very much against prereq classes in university.
Oh,
you should have done that in high school. There's no need to redo things that do not go towards your actual vocational training. I think that's just running up the bill.
So, I went to Portland State, and at Portland State, you have to take what they call this, like, it's like some kind of like core, like you basically had to be a well-rounded student, which I freaking hate that term so much, calling people, mm-hmm. you need to be a well-rounded student, but you had to take this course of study. You had to pick one of them that had nothing to do with your degree. So like I was in chemistry. I was a molecular biology student. Taking minoring in analytical chemistry. And then I had to take a class in like freaking urban planning and like urban parks. And like, that was like the whole, like, and I just hated those classes, hated them. Yeah. I took every one of them as just pass fail.
Right.
There was no grade associated with them.
What is the quote that the purpose of university is to make men as little like their fathers as possible? So it's just basically like social disruption. If you see it that way, why is it their job to mold you into a well-rounded person? Should be their job to either turn you into an engineer or a doctor or a professor, whatever, right? Not teach you how to be in life. I'm going to find the quote.
College just became another scam created by the Federal Reserve elites to enrich themselves and the institution's academics.
Yep.
Hammondite says a trade school of 2-year college pays or you would have a better chance of getting a job. A college and university are different. One is more hands-on while the university is more well-rounded. I don't know. But yeah, this is why go into the trades. Like, don't waste money on freaking college unless
ROI. That's what like college should be. It should be like the trades for specific like academic pursuits, you know, like chemistry or biology or, you know, like history. Like it should, because it's about the same length as going from an apprentice to a journeyman is about 4 to 5 years. It's about the same length of time. And yes. So it's like, when I was apprenticing carpentry, at no point did I ever have to go learn HVAC. There's no point in that. There's no reason for that. Well, I didn't have to go learn some plumbing.
Yeah, that's what they do in Europe. So if you're going to go to law school for the university, they don't make you take all these BS classes. You go and then that's your track. Like you go and you become a lawyer. Like that's what you do at the universities there. So they don't like put you through all these BS, like, you know, history of American folktales classes and stuff like that, which I had to take in my first few years before I went more into my discipline of history and you know, journalism, whatever. But
it was Woodrow Wilson who would eventually become the president when he was at Princeton.
The worst president in United States history.
Who said the use of university is to make young gentlemen as unlike their fathers as possible. Why would I pay for that? To make our kids hate us. Why would I do that? I'm just wondering. So anyway, let us know what you think. Before we go today, we want to tell you about our friends at NetSuite, because they say that every day that your business is late to the AI revolution, you fall 2 days behind. But how do you keep up? The competition is only moving faster. Well, fortunately, there is NetSuite Next. Now, you probably know NetSuite. It is AI-powered business management, and they have a suite that securely connects all of your data. It is a unified suite that brings your financial, inventory, commerce, HR, and CRM into a single source of truth, trusted by over 43,000 customers. So this is the next huge leap in how business gets done, because AI is built into everything you do, woven through your entire business plan, not just AI for finances and AI for human resources, but one collective suite. So whether your company earns millions or even hundreds of millions, it is time for NetSuite Next, where your business meets AI. Check out their suite of offerings at netsuite.ai/redacted. One more time, that's netsuite.ai/redacted. And for the first time ever, you can try NetSuite Next for free. If your revenues are at least in the seven figures, go to netsuite.ai/redacted. It's built for every industry, ready for every boardroom. netsuite.ai/redacted. And again, check out if you are eligible to try it for free. netsuite.ai/redacted.
So Remnant in our chat room says Woodrow Wilson, who of course helped the 1913 Federal Reserve come to power. No.
Oh, that dude.
Yes, absolutely.
That one.
That dude.
That's the bastard we're talking about. Yep.
Worst president in American history.
Oh, I mean, I could go toe-to-toe with him and, you know, Roosevelt, but yeah, pretty bad, pretty bad. And yet here we are.
Well, Trump's not done yet, so we can't really.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly right.
All right. So. Well, hey, we should tell you about our newsletter. We have a daily newsletter. It's published Monday through Friday. It's a great newsletter. Hundreds of thousands of you are subscribers. Just go to redacted.inc. And then right at the top of the page, that's our website. It's not .com. It's .inc. Just click the newsletter link at the top and sign up. And then you'll receive a welcome email. Just make sure it doesn't go to your spam folder or your junk folder or something. Gmail labels us as dangerous, so it might go in your dangerous folder. But just drag it into your inbox and click the link in the email and that you want to receive the newsletter, and you'll receive it starting tomorrow morning. You can read it in about 5 or 10 minutes over your cup of coffee. Great way to start your day, covering stories that you're not going to see other places with a little bit of humor, and a great way to start your day. Anyway, thanks to everyone on this Community Wednesday. Thanks for all of your great feedback in the chat room today. Great to see everybody. We'll be back here tomorrow at 4 p.m. Eastern time. We've got a great interview lined up tomorrow that I'm very excited about. Can't wait to dive deep into America's food supply. That's what we're going to talk about tomorrow here on the show. So thanks, everyone. Have a great night.